Numbers, chapter 10, verse 11 to chapter 11, verse 35. The sixth talk in a series on Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on March 17, 2018 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 6, Numbers 10:11 to 11:35, accompanies this talk.
We'll be going back into the book of Numbers, where we left off in chapter 10. As I talked about when I started this series on Numbers, what I'm interested in is developing cultural literacy. That is, I would like to know the kinds of things that people, especially in the time of the New Testament was written, I would like to know the kinds of things that they knew culturally, what literature they were familiar with, what stories they were familiar with, what values they held, etc. And so what I'm doing is in 2015, I started in the book of Exodus and worked through the book of Exodus, and now I'm doing Numbers and working through Numbers, and I'm not sure where I'll go next. But the Pentateuch is, I think, really critical to this project, understanding the first five books of the Bible in particular and the stories that are there and what that all communicates. And I've been through these books before in years past, for anyone who has a good enough memory, but back then I was more interested in these books as a source of history. Now I'm more interested in these books as a complete work. So I'm not just interested in the historical passages, but I'm interested in understanding the work as a whole. My wife and I recently read through the Gospel of Luke. Right at the end of Luke, there's an interesting little incident that's described. It's after Jesus had been crucified and rose from the dead. He joins a couple of his disciples that are walking near Emmaus, just west of Jerusalem, a few miles. And they are talking about all these things that have just happened, and Jesus just joins them. They don't recognize him and enters into the conversation. And after it becomes clear what it is that they are talking about exactly, then Jesus says in Luke 24:27, "And beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures." When I read that, I thought, I would like to hear that. I wish somebody had turned on their iPhone and recorded that and passed that down. But short of being able to hear that talk, I would at least like to be in a position to understand that talk if it were given. And that's what I'm thinking about with respect to cultural literacy. I would like to have the background that is necessary to make sense of that story that Jesus would tell as he marches through the Old Testament and explains why he had to come and die. So that's what I'm about. Now, what are the events leading into chapter 11 of Numbers? Going way back then to, well, we'll just go back to Exodus. Remember that the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt, and God, using Moses, brought them out of slavery in Egypt using the heavy hand of 10 plagues that he inflicted upon the Egyptians to cause Pharaoh to let them go. The last of those being the killing of all of the firstborn of the Egyptians in order to force Pharaoh to let them go. He does finally let them go, and they flee, and they go through the Red Sea. God opens up the Red Sea when they're trapped with Pharaoh's armies coming after them because Pharaoh had second thoughts about letting them go. They go through on dry land. The water comes in and swamps the chariots of Pharaoh that were following them. Then they make this trek through the desert. It's about a month that they are hiking through the desert, making their way to Mount Sinai. And they have several incidents along the way where they run short of water and food, and God provides for them. They get to Mount Sinai, and God speaks to them, and they hear his voice. And he tells them he wants to make a covenant with them, that he will be their God, and they will be his people, and that they need to obey the law that he presents to them. So Moses goes up on the mountain to receive that law. And while he is up on the mountain, and he's there for 40 days, the people of Israel violate the laws that they had been given initially, the Ten Commandments, and they create an idol and worship the idol because they're afraid that God has abandoned them. And so Moses comes back down from the mountain, and God judges the people through Moses, and God wanted to kill them. He wanted to wipe them all out and replace them with Moses and his descendants. But Moses said, no, don't do that. You would be going back on the promises that you made, and it would be short-selling yourself and your glory to do that. And as a result, God relented and said that he would not kill them. And there are three times then that Moses talks to Yahweh, and each time gets further concessions out of God. And what Moses is interested in is that God be fully on board with his people and be fully supportive of them. And in particular, that God would be with his people. And finally, God agrees to that complete reconciliation, which he agrees to be with them. So then he gives them instructions on how to build the tabernacle. The tabernacle is his tent in their midst, so that he is indeed with them. They build the tabernacle, and then God comes down in a cloud that enters into the tabernacle as a symbol of his presence in their midst. So that's what we read about in Exodus. Then the first 10 chapters in Numbers is all organizational. They're getting themselves organized for the rest of the journey that they are about to make. There is a census made of the people in order to organize them as a fighting force, as an army, which was typically done at the time. And each group is organized, leadership established, and tasks assigned. Then there's another census, and this census is both to count the people to determine how many firstborn there are and how many Levites there are. But also the Levites in this process are organized to transport the tabernacle. Then we have an updating. There's some laws that are modified, laws that had already been given. Now they're modified, added to, I should say, suggesting that the laws are still important and that the giving of the laws is not a one-time thing, but there is to a certain extent things that are clarified and added as time goes on. We'll see that there are more later in Numbers. Then offerings are taken for the tabernacle and the Levites. The Levites are consecrated, the temple is consecrated, and then there is the celebration of the Passover. So this is the second Passover. This is 1 year later. So it takes them about 1 month to get to Mount Sinai. They're there for about a year, almost a year. And then a little later, they take off. And there's some measures taken to organize exactly how they will coordinate their marching activities with trumpets and the order of marching. So we are ready now, in the middle of chapter 10, to start walking. Verse 11. Now it came about, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th of the month, that the cloud was lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony, and the sons of Israel set out on their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. So they moved out for the first time according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses. And the standard of the camp of the sons of Judah according to their armies set out first with Nashon, the son of Amminadab, over its army, and Nethanel, the son of Zuar, over the tribal family or tribal army of the sons of Issachar, and Eliab, the son of Helon, over the tribal army of the sons of Zebulun. Then the tabernacle was taken down, and the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, who were carrying the tabernacle, set out. Next, the standard of the camp of Reuben, according to their armies, set out with Elizur and the son of Sedur over his army, and Shelumiel, the son of Zerishaddai, over the tribal army of the sons of Simon, and Eliasaph, the son of Duel, was over the tribal army of the sons of Gad. Then the Kohathites set out, carrying the holy objects, and the tabernacle was set up before their arrival. Next, the standard of the camp of the sons of Ephraim, according to their armies, set out, with Elishama, the son of Amihud, over its army, and Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur, over the tribal army of the sons of Manasseh, and Abadan, the son of Gideoni, over the tribal army of the sons of Benjamin. Then the standard of the camp of the sons of Dan, according to their armies, which formed the rear guard for all the camps, set out with Ahiezer, the son of Aminishadai, over its army, and Pagiel, the son of Okran, over the tribal army of the sons of Asher, and Ahira, the son of Enon, over the tribal army of the sons of Naphtali. This was the order of march of the sons of Israel by the armies as they set out. Okay, so they are starting out. It tells us the date on which this is happening. It's the second year and the second month on the 20th of the month. That's all dated from the time of the departure from Egypt. So it's been a little over a year before they start out. And they're headed for Paran, which is a large desert area in the northern part of Sinai. Mount Sinai is at the southern part of the peninsula. Ashley says the departure date here is over 11 months after their arrival at the mountain, nearly 14 months after their departure from Egypt, and 19 days after the census of verse 1:1. So just get to orient you chronologically. It says in here that the cloud is going to lead the way. It rises up and goes forward, and it will lead them all the way to Paran. The camp then sets out in following the cloud. Just as it was described earlier in Numbers, the three tribes that were camped on the east side of the camp, they start out. The three tribes that were at the south part, they go next. Then the priests go, and then the tribes on the west side, and then followed by the tribes on the north side of the camp. It is interesting that there are some departures here from the description of how they are supposed to set out described earlier in Numbers. Gershon and Merari were supposed to go with the other priests after the eastern tribes and the southern tribes. Then it was supposed to be the priests. But Gershon and Merari go before that. They go after the tribes from the east set out. If you'll recall, they are carrying the posts and the rails that are necessary for setting up the tabernacle. I think Gershon is carrying those. Then Merari is carrying the curtains. So they set out earlier than was described earlier in Numbers. And the only thing that is said with respect to that is in 21, it says, then the Kohathites, that's the other set of priests, they set out exactly when they're supposed to. It says they go carrying the holy objects, and the tabernacle was set up before their arrival. So apparently the reason that the other two groups of priests start out early is so that they can go and set up the tabernacle before the Kohathites come with all of the furniture for the tabernacle. So it's for practical reasons that this change is made. It's not clear why the change, who made the change. Another change that's made is that the Ark of the Covenant sets out before everybody else. They were not instructed to do that earlier in Numbers. I'll talk about those two changes later in the conclusion. Next section, 10:29. Then Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, "We are setting out to the place of which the Lord said, 'I will give it to you.' Come with us, and we will do you good, for the Lord has promised good concerning Israel." But he said to him, "I will not come, but rather I will go to my own land and relatives." Then he said, "Please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will be as eyes for us. So it will be, if you go with us, it will come about that whatever good the Lord does for us, we will do for you." This is a curious little section, I think. The first question is, who is Hobab? When it says Hobab, the son of Reuel the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, the question is, does Moses' father-in-law refer to Reuel, or does it refer to Hobab? And there have been many articles written on this. This is a difficult little puzzle to solve. In Exodus, it had talked about Jethro being the father-in-law of Moses. It didn't say Reuel or Hobab. The data on this question is hard to sort out. That's what all of those articles are trying to do. But it seems to me that the best solution offered that I'm aware of is that Jethro is the father-in-law of Moses. Reuel is either another name for Jethro or it's a title for his position in the Midianite tribe. So Reuel and Jethro are the same person. Hobab, then, is Moses' brother-in-law. I think that's the best solution to this. So, assuming that that's the case, Moses is asking Hobab to stay with them and go with them into the promised land. God has promised to do good things for the Israelites, and so Moses says, good will be done to you. You will benefit from that, those blessings that God bestows on Israel. Hobab says, no thanks. So Moses comes back and he really presses him and says, "Please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will be as eyes for us." In other words, in Moses' mind, they need a scout. They need someone who knows this desert. And Hobab, since he's Moses' brother-in-law, he's a Midianite. This is his home turf. He knows this area very well. And Moses wants Hobab to go with them because he knows the area so well. And Moses says, so it will be, if you go with us, it will come about that whatever good the Lord does for us, we will do for you. And Moses promises that the blessings that God bestows on the Israelites, Hobab will benefit from those. They will be passed on to him. There is no indication in the text what Hobab ultimately decides to do, which I think is interesting. There's no response recorded here, and there is no mention of Hobab in the rest of the Pentateuch. However, Ashley, a commentator, says, this text does not disclose whether Hobab was convinced by Moses' entreaties. But if Hobab's name is original to the text of Judges 1:16, and he says, as is possible, then his descendants were still with the Israelites in the conquest period. So there are some texts that include his name in Judges as being a part of the Israelites. Now, as I understand it, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law and his daughter Zipporah and Hobab were all Midianites, and they were not just Midianites, they were part of a sub-tribe called the Kenites, who apparently were well known for their ability to do metalworking. So if that's true, then Hobab is one of those Kenites, and we know later on that there were some Kenites that joined in with the Israelites and were a part of things when they went into the Promised Land. So it's possible that Hobab is one of those Kenites that joined Israel. I suspect that's the case. I suspect that Hobab did indeed join them. It is interesting, though, that we have this little scene just as the Israelites are leaving Mount Sinai, and the last scene we have before they arrive at Sinai is Jethro talking to Moses and advising him to appoint 70 judges to help him judge the people. So we have Jethro just before Sinai. We have Hobab just after the Sinai. And I'll talk about this later, but there are a number of things that happen before Sinai that have a parallel after Sinai. There are four or five things that could be pointed out that are similar before to those that are after. And I'll talk about that later. Next section, 33 through 36. Thus they set out from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey, with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord journeying in front of them for 3 days to seek out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they set out from the camp. Then it came about when the ark set out that Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let those who hate thee flee before thee." And when it came to rest, he said, "Return thou, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel." So they've gone 3 days before the events in chapter 11 take place. The Ark of the Covenant is going ahead of them, and it sounds like they end up stopping at least briefly after 3 days, and the events in chapter 11 take place. The cloud is moving also in front of them as well. As the ark sets out, apparently each day, Moses says these words, "It's rise up, O Lord, and thine enemies be scattered, and let those who hate thee flee before thee." So scattering the enemies, keeping them out of the way. That's what the ark symbolizes there. And then when they camp, what he says every time is, "Return thou, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel." And again, that's "be with us." God with us is the thing that keeps getting repeated. Chapter 11. Now the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled. And the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. The people therefore cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. So the name of that place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned against them. This first sentence in the NIV, I think, is a little clearer. The NIV reads, "Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord." So complaints start happening 3 days into their march from Mount Sinai. If you will recall, when they left Egypt, after they went past through the Red Sea, guess how long it was till the first complaints were registered? 3 days. So another parallel between the before and the after. The people as a whole seem to be expressing their discontent, saying they are not happy. It sounds like they were relatively happy, settled in at Mount Sinai for the year that they were there. It's when they start marching that things get difficult and the complaints begin. We're going to see that the complaining is going to be a theme that's going to run through the next couple of chapters. And it's just like the complaining that occurred when they left Egypt. However, notice this time, God's response to their complaining is different. The response that God had to their complaining after they had left Egypt was whatever they were complaining about, God provided it. This time, we're going to see that his response to their complaining is punishment of one kind or another. In response to their complaining this time, God became angry. And he sends fire down and it burns the outskirts of the camp. It's not clear whether we're talking about brush that's just outside the camp that burns, or whether it's actually tents that are on the edge of the camp that get burned. But there is a fire that people clearly relate to the activity of God that takes place. So the people cry out to Moses, and Moses, ever since Mount Sinai, Moses has been their intercessor. He's the one intermediary that they turn to. So they turn to Moses, they ask him to deal with it, Moses prays, and the fire stops. The place is then named to memorialize the event with Taberah, which means burning. The naming of places according to what happens at that place becomes common as we proceed through Numbers. Verses 4 through 9. And the rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna." Now the manna was like coriander seed and its appearance like that of bdellium. The people would go about and gather it and grind it between two millstones, or beat it in the mortar and boil it in the pot and make cakes with it. And its taste was as the taste of cakes baked with oil. And when the dew fell on the camp at night, the manna would fall with it. So now we're getting more complaints, and these are more specific. The complaints originate from the rabble, or one commentator suggested riffraff, because the Hebrew word sounds more like riffraff. And it says the rabble who were among them had greedy desires. Then it goes on to say, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said. So the rabble starts it, and then the sons of Israel pick up on the refrain. So who are the rabble? It would appear that the rabble is a reference to the mixed multitude that was referred to in Exodus. When they left Egypt, it says that there was a mixed multitude that went with them. So these are non-Israelites who joined them when they left Egypt. It is apparently then that group that begins this set of complaints, and then the Israelites join in with it. The fact that the rabble start this is going to be significant next week when we look at chapter 12. It says that the rabble had greedy desires. That is to say, they've got desires that outrun the provision. And so they are inclined to be complainers. Ashley says, with respect to this, the immediate context gives no cause for this murmuring, so there's no initiating event. Indeed, it occurs in the context of Yahweh's gracious provision for the guidance and leadership of his people on the way. Thus, the complaining is more striking and contrasts with the murmuring found in the book of Exodus and that which follows in Numbers 11, 4 through 34, both of which had external causes. So there's nothing really that provokes this. They just are unsatisfied with their diet. And it's the lack of variety in their diet that they are primarily complaining about. Who will give us meat to eat? They would like something other than just manna. They want meat. And they say, and this is a great line, they say, "We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt." So we had fish that was absolutely free in Egypt, and we don't have that now. And we wish we had it. That was so nice. And in addition, we had cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. All those wonderful foods that we don't have now. I love the line that we ate fish, free fish in Egypt, because in Egypt they were slaves. They weren't free. Now they're free. They don't value that. The fact that they have been freed from their slavery isn't valued. They've lost sight of that. They just don't have free fish anymore. It's amazing what human beings will do for free food. Our appetite is gone. We no longer feel like eating. It just isn't tasty. And you get the sense that it isn't that they're lacking in food. It isn't that they're hungry. Their stomachs are empty. It's just they're bored with the food that they do have. There is nothing for our eyes. There's nothing aesthetically pleasing to what we're looking at. We have only manna. The only thing we've got here is manna that comes down magically from the heaven every night, and it's spread on the ground free for the taking. That's all we got. Okay. It is interesting to me, I was thinking through the chronology of this. It was about a month earlier or less that they had eaten lots of meat as a part of the consecration ceremonies for the tabernacle and the priests and the Levites and the celebration of the Passover. They would have killed a Passover lamb for each household at the Passover, which was celebrated just a few weeks before they left. So it's not like they have been meat deprived for all the time since they left Egypt. But they haven't had meat recently, and that's apparently the cause of their complaint. The text then adds this description of manna and what they did with it. And it seems to me that the description sounds pleasant, if not quite attractive. And it fell every night like clockwork. It was dependable. Okay, I can certainly identify with that passage. We'll talk about that more later. Next section. Now Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, each man at the doorway of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly, and Moses was displeased. So Moses said to the Lord, "Why hast thou been so hard on thy servant? And why have I not found favor in thy sight, that thou hast laid the burden of all this people on me? Was it I who conceived all this people? Was it I who brought them forth? That you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing infant to the land which thou didst swear to their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep before me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. I alone am not able to carry all this people because it is too burdensome for me. So if thou art going to deal with thus with me, please kill me at once. If I have found favor in thy sight, and if I have found favor in thy sight, and do not let me see my wretchedness." So here's Moses' response. It is very different from the response that we saw at Mount Sinai when God wanted to wipe out the Israelites. Here his response is, this is too much for me to bear. This is too burdensome. This people, they just keep coming to my door. They keep asking for food. They ask for meat. And I can't do it. I don't have it. He says, I alone am not able to carry all this people because it is too burdensome for me. So he says, it'd be better if you just took my life. I can't do this. Next section, verse 16. The Lord therefore said to Moses, gather for me 70 men from the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and their officers, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their stand there with you. Then I will come down and speak with you there, and I will take of the Spirit who is upon you, and will put him upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you shall not bear it alone. So there are these two issues that God is addressing here. One is the people's complaint about needing meat. And the other one is Moses' complaint about this people is too burdensome for me to deal with. He responds to Moses first. And what he says to Moses is, gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel. So you're going to bring in the 70 elders from among Israel. You're going to bring them to the tent of meeting. I will meet you there. And then I am going to come down and I'm going to take the spirit that's upon you and I am going to put it on them as well so that they can help you bear the burden of this people. The next section. Oh, I think, just a sec. This is referring to the situation that Moses faces. This is Ashley's comment on that. He said, Moses sees his loneliness in leadership as a judgment of God and requests that, if he has found any favor in God's sight, he be killed now rather than carrying on as he has been and being seen as inadequate to find food for the people. The reader is not told why Moses cannot share the leadership with those elders who were appointed while still at Mount Sinai. If you'll recall, what Ashley's referring to here is there were 70 elders appointed when they first arrived at Mount Sinai at the suggestion of Jethro. But those elders were appointed to help Moses judge all the disputes that were arising among the people of Israel. Now it appears that what God is suggesting or is commanding is that Moses select another 70. And their job is a little different. It's not to judge the people. Their job is to help bear the burden of the people, share the responsibility for the decisions that are made, and therefore diffuse the complaints that are coming towards Moses and wearing him down. Okay, so God is going to establish these other leaders to help share that burden with Moses. The next section. And say to the people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, oh, that someone would give us meat to eat, for we were well off in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? But Moses said, the people among whom I am are 600,000 on foot. Yet thou hast said, I will give them meat in order that they shall eat for a whole month. Should flocks and herds be slaughtered for them to be sufficient for them? Or should all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to be sufficient for them? And the Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's power limited? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. So how's he dealing with the complaints of the people? God says, I'm going to provide the meat. They will eat meat. They have asked for meat. They have begged for meat. They will eat meat. And not just 1 day or 2 days or 5 days or 10 days. They're going to eat meat for a month. And they're going to eat it to the point that they're sick of it. And it comes out of their nostrils. And then Moses says, where am I going to get all that meat? Which is interesting because Moses never asked that kind of question to similar situations earlier. Moses never asked, how are you going to pull that off, God? But this time he does. How are you going to pull that off? And God's response to Moses is, the Lord's power limited? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. Next section. So Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord. Also he gathered 70 men of the elders of the people and stationed them around the tent. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him. And he took the spirit who was upon him, and placed him upon the 70 elders, And it came about that when the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, but they did not do it again. So God does as he had said. He spreads the Spirit over these 70 elders. And I think it's as a sign that that has indeed happened, these 70 elders prophesy. So I think that was as a sign given by God to show that what he said he was going to do, that is, give them the Spirit, he had in fact done. But they did not do it again. That sign was not repeated. They get it once, that's all they need. Now a curious incident in this next paragraph. But two men had remained in the camp. The name of one was Eldad, and the name of the other, Medad, and the Spirit rested upon them. Now they were among those who had been registered, but had not gone out to the tent. And they prophesied in the camp. So a young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, the attendant of Moses from his youth, answered and said, Moses, my Lord, restrain them. But Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his Spirit upon them. Then Moses returned to the camp, both he and the elders of Israel. So while this is happening, while the 68 elders that God had asked Moses to gather at the tabernacle, they had done that, and the Spirit had come down upon them, and they had prophesied, and people had seen that. But for some reason, we don't know why, two of those elders didn't make it to the tabernacle. They're still in the camp. But the Spirit of God comes on them as well, and they start prophesying. And word of this gets back to Moses and Joshua, his assistant. And Joshua is concerned about this. And he says, Moses, my Lord, restrain them. Joshua is concerned that there are people who are exercising authority or going to exercise authority who haven't been legitimately established as being authoritative under Moses. So Joshua is jealous for Moses' power. And Joshua thinks that something should be done to bring them under control. Moses' response is very different. Moses' response is, would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his Spirit upon them. Moses isn't concerned that there are going to be people exercising authority that are not fully under his control. Then Moses returned to the camp, both he and the elders of Israel. Okay, remember this for next week, because one of the complaints that we will see next week in chapter 12 is that Moses is power hungry. And I think that the reason that this passage is here is to help establish the case that no, indeed, Moses is not power hungry. Okay, the last section. Now there went forth a wind from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea, and let them fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, and about 2 cubits deep on the surface of the ground. And the people spent all day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. While the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people. And the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague. So the name of that place was called Kibroth Hatava, because there they buried the people who had been greedy. From Kiriath Hatava, the people set out for Hazeroth, and they remained at Hazeroth. So God does provide the meat as he said that he would. It's in the form of quail, just as he had done on the journey to Mount Sinai. Again, he provides them with quail. And presumably it's by the same mechanism that I described when we went through Exodus, that there is this phenomenon that is recorded, Aristotle refers to it, that quail that are migrating, and I'm not sure exactly where they're migrating, but they're migrating someplace in the Mediterranean Sea area, under certain conditions, they get blown across the Mediterranean Sea a long distance, and when they reach the Sinai Peninsula, they are absolutely exhausted. And those quail just flop on the ground, and they're too tired to fly away or to run or anything. They are easily grabbed. And apparently, people from Egypt used to do that. And that's what Aristotle is talking about. So presumably it's that kind of phenomenon again, but this is in huge quantities. It says, doesn't it say 2 cubits deep? 2 cubits deep, a cubit is 18 inches, so that's about 3 feet. Well, that's worse than the snowfall we got. That would crush many roofs. So that's about a 3 foot deep pile of quail. So they go out and gather this stuff, and then they spread it out to dry in the sun, which was something that they did, apparently. It was commonly done. They're spreading it out to dry, and it would appear that what happened is when they spread it out to dry, some of it did not get dry fast enough or fully enough, and so there's a problem of food poisoning that develops. So they're eating this quail, and it's not clear how long they've been eating it before they start to get symptoms, but they eat this stuff, and then I would assume they're vomiting it up because it's coming out of their nostrils. There are times when I have vomited in such a way that stuff came out of my nostrils, and it's not pleasant. Okay, so they named this place Kibroth Hattaavah, which means the graves of greediness. I mean, the greediness was mentioned earlier, that was the thing that was driving all of this. Then they go on to Hazarot, and they camp there. And that's where they will be when we go into the next chapter. Okay, there are about 3 things I'd like to comment on about this section, and then there should be time for questions. The first one, I think this passage is fascinating. There are just so many things of interest in it. I could have picked more to talk about, but one that I find, it may seem irrelevant to you, but I find it very interesting. Remember that I mentioned that the order of the march that they went out from Mount Sinai was different from what had been commanded by God earlier in Numbers. They sent the Ark of the Covenant first. That was not what was said earlier. It was supposed to be in the middle with the other furniture from the temple. And they sent out 2 of the priestly tribes after the first group of Israelites had gone, rather than waiting for the middle. I don't know why they made these changes. I don't know if God commanded them to make these changes or whether they just decided that it was the best thing to do. But it seems to me that there is flexibility in what God commands. And I talked about that earlier in Exodus. And I find that interesting. There's another thing in this passage that I find that it seems to me is related, and that is, why did they need a guide? Why does Moses talk to Hobab and say, we need a guide? I'd always thought, well, they've got this pillar that's going out in front of them and showing them the way. Why do they need a guide? But what Moses suggests is they need someone who can find a place for them to camp. So in reading that and putting things together, it seems to me that the kind of guidance that is provided by this cloud that goes before them is rather general in nature. They see this cloud, it's out in front of them. They know that they have to go toward it, and to go toward it, they have to go over this mountain. But they aren't told where the pass is. They have to find that. So they need a guide that can help them with the details of how it is that they are going to follow this pillar of fire that's out in front of them. So the guidance that God is giving them is rather general. They have to figure out, how do I put my feet in front of each other in such a way that I get there, get to where God has indicated that I need to go. And it just seems to me that God has so constructed things that he gives us guidance, but there's a lot that has to be worked out by us, and he wants it that way. There's a lot that's left for us to figure out the details of, given the guidance that he has provided. The second thing, in this section, especially chapter 11, there are two kinds of complaints, and I find the contrast between those is interesting. Everybody's complaining, but there are two kinds. One is the people's complaint. They want to be back in Egypt and have their free fish. The other is the complaint of Moses, because Moses is overwhelmed by the complaints and the attitude of the people. God responds very differently to these two kinds of complaints. So there's a huge difference between them from God's perspective. The people are fundamentally ungrateful and constantly discontented. From God's perspective, their complaints are indicative of rebellion against him and ingratitude against him. Moses, on the other hand, he sees as one who is emotionally exhausted. He's on board with God's agenda, but he's just worn out, and God responds to him accordingly. What does he need? What would ease the burden on him? So what the people need to do is repent and come around. What Moses needs is rest and relaxation. What Moses needs is a break from the pressures. And God graciously comes along and provides that. As I was reading through this, I was surprised at Moses' response to this. I had forgotten that he responded this way. And I would have to say that the picture of Moses in Exodus is more impressive, especially the way that Moses acts on Mount Sinai. Here it's less impressive, but it's more human. It's really easy to identify with this and understand how Moses could have reached the place where he is just exhausted. From God's perspective, the complaints of the people is damnable, but the complaint of Moses is just human foible. And God sees those differently and deals with them differently. God is both fierce and gentle. The third thing I want to point out, as I mentioned before, there are several things that happen before they get to Mount Sinai that have similarities to things that happen after Sinai. We have the advice from an in-law that happens just before Sinai and happens within the interaction with Hobab just after. The 3 days out and a complaint. The we want meat and the quail provided. And there are others. I think that the text encourages us to compare the before and after picture, what things are like before and what things are like after Mount Sinai. And Mount Sinai is so significant because it's at Mount Sinai that God comes and makes the covenant with the people, and the people agree with the terms of that covenant. What is this comparison supposed to show? It shows us that the people before Mount Sinai acted in a certain way. They were rebels. And the way they act after Sinai is they are rebels. God comes. He makes this gracious deal with them. He displays his power, but it doesn't make any difference in their behavior. It doesn't change them. They are inveterate complainers. They complain before, they complain after. And God doesn't seem to be able to convince them of his commitment to them and to their well-being. I find this very sobering. To look at the people of Israel and what they're doing here, I find it very sobering. Because I am quite certain I would have been one of the complainers. I've been looking at the prophets, and the thing that they point out, the thing that happens time after time, in fact, Ezekiel points it out in the chapter that we just looked at, that there were three times that he points out in the history of Israel where God comes to them and blesses them, and soon thereafter, they rebel against him. So God comes in judgment, and he judges them. But then after he judges them, he relents and he blesses them again. And what happens? They rebel again. And it happens time after time after time. And what you see in the prophets is that when the prophets come to the people of Israel, invariably, the people of Israel think they're good with God. Things are fine. We've worked things out with God. We're doing what he's asked us to do. And the prophets come and they say, no, you haven't. You've got it wrong. You need to repent. And when I combine these, looking at numbers and I look at the prophets, it is very sobering. We are so prone to rebellion and then prone to self-justification and self-righteousness. It's easy for us to convince ourselves that we are good with God. But what God requires is our full devotion to him. And that's what the people of Israel failed to understand time after time after time. I really like the symbolism that the prophets use of a marriage. That the relationship between God and the people of Israel is like a marriage. And what God wants of the people of Israel is for them to be faithful and fully devoted to him as their husband. And anything short of that is adulterous. Any degree to which their devotion is sidetracked onto any other thing, any other God, that is adulterous. So what God wants of us is a purity of heart devoted to him and what he's all about. And it's what's interesting is that on the one hand, that's so simple. On the other hand, that is so hard. But that's what we're called to. Questions?
Thanks, David. Mm-hmm. You started the talk this afternoon by referencing Luke 24, and you sound like you're in process, and I don't want to push you to share something too concrete, but if you could just let down your guard. You know, when Jesus says all the things written about me in the prophets and the Psalms, it's easier to be like, oh, well, there's a lot written about the Messiah and the prophets and the Psalms. So, but in the Law of Moses, it's less clear what he may or may not be thinking. So where are you at in terms of your understanding, if you would, about what Jesus has in mind and how exactly the Law of Moses is pointing to him? Is it just those few places where it talks about, you know, the star rising from Judah and these sorts of things, or is there something else? Is it typology in terms of Moses and the things that happened with Moses, or what's going on there?
The short and truthful answer is I don't know. Now to go on and talk, that is indeed what I'm working on. I'm trying to put things together so that I could give some semblance of an answer to that. But at this point, it seems to me, especially when we're looking at the law, we're looking at the Torah, the Pentateuch, we learn some basic concepts that are critical. And that is who God is, what it is that he values, what are people like, and what do they value, and how can these two be brought together? How can they be reconciled? How can the problem be solved? I think that's really clear in the Pentateuch. Beyond that, it seems to me that there are some pictures that are presented that become really important and helpful devices to talk about other concepts that are important, that become important in the gospel and the understanding of who Jesus was and what he was doing. So at least in those two ways, the Pentateuch is critical.
That second way, can you give like a concrete example of that?
Yeah, Moses at Mount Sinai.
Okay.
What a phenomenal picture mm-hmm. of what Jesus ends up doing mm-hmm. in an even more complete way. I mean, it's a beautiful picture, and it helps to understand what Jesus was all about, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of thing.
Thanks, David. Mm-hmm.
Looking at the translation I'm working with, it's not clear to me that the 70 men that he picked were different 70 mm-hmm. men, mm-hmm. but is there something you noticed that made that clear?
No, it could be the same 70 men. It's not right. Okay. It is not clear.
Okay.
But it does seem to me that it is a different task that they are being given at okay. this point in time.
And that's my next question is, what has emotionally exhausted him? Do you have a picture of that exactly?
My guess is that they had just been at Sinai for a year. And especially after the incident with the golden calf, they're building the tabernacle. People are bringing the gifts. It appears as though they are responding very positively towards God. So I think Moses thinks, now that we have had this experience at Sinai, everything's going to be different. They set out, and it's just like it was, if not worse.
So how are the 70 helping him? Are they...
Well, it sounds like what Moses says is happening is these people are constantly coming to me and saying, give us meat, give us meat, give us meat, as if he is solely responsible for the dilemma that they're in. So what God is saying is the leadership is going to be spread over 70 people. It's not just Moses out on his own doing this crazy thing. There are 70 people who share in his leadership, and therefore there are 70 people that you can address your concerns to. It's not just Moses out on his own.
I was wondering about the prophesying that the 70 do. Do you think there's any similarity to what they're doing as to what the apostles do at Pentecost?
I don't know. I mean, it could be a similar kind of phenomenon, but I don't know what's happening in Acts. I know even less what's happening here, what it looks like. All I know is that it's something that people can actually see happening, and they can associate that with the Spirit coming upon them. But what it looks like, whether they're speaking in other languages or what, I don't know. I don't know.
It kind of looks like whether or not these people were part of the complaining group, it appears that after the Spirit of God is spread around them, I'm guessing that they are on the same page with Moses. So, you know, regardless of whether they were some of these guys sitting in front of their tent whining about lack of meat or not, it seems like they're, you know, now going to be standing with Moses.
Right. I assume that too. We don't know whether they were part of the complaining group or not, but presumably, yes, now that the Spirit is on them, part of what's happening is they are fully on board with what God is leading Moses to do.
The other thing that struck me, I really like what Moses says to Hobab. You know, this whole multitude of people come up into Hobab's homeland, and you know, they get in trouble with their God, and they're trouble from Egypt and all this. And Moses is like, hey, hitch your wagon along with us and come along. And Hobab's like, you know, I'll just stick here. You guys go ahead. And Moses is like, hey, look, dude, you know, God is going to bless us. This is going to be really good, and you should come along with us. Yeah. I think it's really interesting that Moses isn't like, oh, no, look, see, God's kept his promises, and, you know, he brought us out and all this kind of stuff. He's not proving to Hobab, you know, God's reliable. It's just the fact of his argument, the premise of his argument is God's going to be good to us. And I think that that's really interesting to me, because a lot of times when I think of representing Christianity to people who do not believe in Christianity, I think of, oh, I have to, you know, prove to them it's right. And I do think that's part of it. But I think, you know, just getting down to the bare root of the matter is, you know, God is going to be good to us. Mm-hmm. And we are a group that God favors and watches out for and sees how people treat us and that kind of stuff. And conveying that to people, that it's not just a bunch of regulations that you got to follow, you know, that there's a reason for following, and that there's good things going to come. I'm encouraged by Moses being like, this is going to happen here. You should come along, because good things are going to happen.
I suspect that Hobab has some knowledge of God. It's possible that he has been there with them since they got to Sinai, because Jethro was there when they first arrived at Sinai. It could be that Hobab was there, or maybe came and went, but had considerable exposure to them while they were at Sinai. But we also know that Jethro seems to be someone who's responsive to God, and very likely there was information passed from Jethro to Hobab. So I think there's reason to believe that Hobab knows something about this God. And that's why I'm inclined to think when Moses presses him, he says, I'll go. I'm inclined to think that he ended up picking up on the offer. And recognized that God was blessing Israel and was going to continue to bless Israel, and wanted to get in on that blessing.
I had a strange response to Moses' complaint, why me? He almost seems like he's saying, oh, I know it's me, but why me? He's saying, like saying, this job's too big for me, too hard for me, but he never doubts that it's his.
Right.
Right? He never says, I quit, I'm out of here. You can kill me if you want to. That would be a real favor, but it's an odd sort of tension he's living with, to say, I am God's chosen. He has appointed me to this, and there's nothing else I can do. But geez, God, this is just too much, right?
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
And he has sort of not a fatalistic, but a conviction, an unbreakable conviction that this is my job.
And you can see why that might be. He's done this since they left Egypt. And I'm sure he's looking around and says, I don't see anybody else to replace me. God seems to have put me in this role, and so I need to do the job that I've been put here to do, but I can't do it anymore. So now what do we do? And that's when God comes in and diffuses the burden that's been on his shoulders.
If he'd said, I quit, he would have been the same as the complainers. Because they too have been appointed to leave Egypt and go to the promised land, mm-hmm. in being freed. But they're saying, no, this is too hard. Mm-hmm. I'd rather be a slave. Mm-hmm. And I say, no, that's not what I have for you. So lace them up tight and ruck up and let's go. And
yeah. Yeah, it seems to me that Moses is in a situation where the only way out that he can see is if he dies. And the only way for him to die would be if God were to be so gracious as to take his life. So that's what he asks happen.
It's a peculiar state of faithfulness.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah.
I find it really reassuring. God's response is very gracious towards Moses. There's no condemnation whatsoever. It's, I'll get you help. I understand what's going on here. You're exhausted. Okay.
it reminds me of when the children of Israel say they want to have a king. They really want to have a king. And Samuel's all disappointed about that. Mm-hmm. And God says to him, hey, don't worry. They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. Yeah. It's just such a gracious thing to do.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.